The constraint to fixed norm is not just motivated by the idea that I'm trying to implement, but it's also essential, I think, to having any chance for the theory to be stable, energetically stable. So it's a good thing to fix the norm. There are other precursors. I think the earliest paper I know that wrote down basically the theory that I'm going to talk about was by Gasparini in the 80s. He did it in a tetrad formalism and basically picked out a direction in the local Lorentz space that was preferred in the Lagrangian. And if you translate that into just straight tensor language without any tetrads, you get the theory that I'm talking about today. So many of you have heard me talk about this before, and I hope that you'll hear a few new results. I've been kind of locked into this since a couple of years. I just want to know, is it viable? Can we, you know, here's the question. Is this theory going to be something that's just thrown out because it's just dynamically inconsistent, or it's obviously unstable? Or is it going to be constrained by observations in the sense that the free coefficients in the Lagrangian that I'll write down in a moment are just bounded by some values by observations of gravitational waves, cosmology, and so forth. So, and I'd like to say at the beginning, I've been working on this with students at Maryland, Chris Ewing, Brendan Foster, and David Mattingly, who's now graduated. And many other people have worked on aspects of this, and I'll try to remember to mention some of them. So what's the action? We have a metric, and this is a unit vector field, unit time-life vector field. So we're going to start out with using plus, minus, minus signature, 16 pi g, and we go upward. So I start with the Einstein-Hilbert term, and then want to put in something that's going to be the ether Lagrangian Lu. And, well, I either implement the constraint that this be unit just by hand in the action, solving, for instance, for one component in terms of the others, or I can put in a Lagrangian multiplier. We put it explicitly here. So the question is, what am I going to choose for the Lagrangian of the ether? And the choice is basically to just write everything I can possibly write consistent with general covariance and at the same order in the derivative expansion as we think of this term as appearing, that is two derivatives. So luckily, there aren't that many things I can write. So what LU is, it's some combination of a quadratic thing in derivatives of U. And I just have to contract the indices. So I have some tensor here made out of G and U and other invariant tensors that I can contract with. So what is K? Well, I could have the metric, the inverse metric and the metric. I could have Kronecker and deltas. I could flip the indices on the delta. And I could actually, so far I haven't used U in K, but I could use U. So I'll add a term like that, UA, UB, GMN. The reason I don't add U on the MN indices is that U is constrained to be a unit vector, so if I were to contract this thing with UM, I would get zero because it's proportional to the gradient of U squared, and U squared is fixed to be one. One other term that you might think you could write down is the Ricci tensor contracted twice with U. that has the same number of derivatives, but this thing can be re-expressed as a combination of the C2 and C3 terms. I think that's what it is.
What about simply divergence of G term?
That's what this one is.
No, that.
Oh, a single divergence.
Yeah.
That's a total divergence.
Right.
Yeah, I'm throwing out total divergence. So I just have really a theory specified by these four parameters. I pulled out this overall G, so these C's are dimensionless parameters. And they, you know, define the theory. So the question is, are there any values of these C's that give you a stable, healthy theory, and what are the observational constraints on the C's?
I forget if it's contravariant or covariant, but why the index is upstairs rather than downstairs?
On what? I probably wrote it wrong.
On you.
Oh, you get to choose. I like it this way because it simplifies the stress tensor because there are less G's in K. But obviously, you can make a field redefinition. You could use the lower U for your field variable, and that's fine.
It's already aiming at the classical theory, is that right?
Yes.
Because in quantum theory, I suppose there could be some non-triviality, because if you don't allow the field to go to zero,
yeah,
then this has topological consequences,
yeah,
right? And if you implement your constraint is in the Lagrange multiplier, in quantum theory, you're exploring the space of solutions also where you allow for zero. So there are topologically different situations explored.
I'm not so sure about that. This is similar to a nonlinear sigma model where the very nature of the field is constrained. It takes values on the hyperboloid in each tangent space, and then
it's just contractible. So.
On the other hand, also, I mean, going to zero, well, it's certainly no more well-behaved quantum mechanically than pure Einstein gravity is. I'm not trying to introduce this to, for that reason. Yes.
Having no terms which are odd, I think it doesn't mind something.
Right. I mean, this is the whole thing. Up to this order in derivatives.
So you would have to go to higher order to have an effect in your field counter for some place.
If you're talking about the purely gravity ether sector, yes.
What about
coupling? Ether is matter.
Coupling is matter.
Yes.
In the way that you're trying to resolve.
Yes.
That would be very constraining, experimental.
It is, that's enough. Okay, so what are the basic properties of this Lagrangian or action? First of all, we know that pure gravity has a scale symmetry. If we scale the metric, that just scales the overall action. The same thing is true here. If we scale u in the same way as the square root of the inverse metric, because k is scale and invariant then, and the covariant derivative is scale and invariant, and so these two u's scale like the inverse g and the 3g. So this has a scale symmetry, and that's not useful for changing the form of it, but there's another interesting field redefinition possibility that is. So, you know, I wanted to say that. GAB, let's say A squared GAB, UA goes to A inverse, UA scales action. But another thing you can do is say, well, wait a minute, I have a metric and I have a unit vector, but I could use the unit vector to construct a new metric and re-express the action in terms of the new metric and the ether instead of this one. And then what would that do? Well, the new metric I could construct it so the ether is still is a unit, or I could rescale the ether, and that's what I'm going to do. So let's consider a field redefinition of this form. B minus 1 So I'll add some multiple of UU to the metric and get a new metric. If V were zero, then I'd be subtracting off all of the, imagine constructing an orthonormal basis where this unit vector is one, is the time-like basis vector, then the minus one UU would subtract off the time part of the metric and leave you with just a purely spatial metric. So to keep this to having Lorentz signature, I should have V greater than zero. So consider that, and then redefine, well, have another U field that's just scaled so that relative to G prime, U prime is a unit vector, and this requires this. Now, of course, since in U squared is constrained to be 1, I could replace this by B, the denominator of square root of B. But just technically, if you do that before you plug this into the action, then you find that the constraint is quartic instead of quadratic, and there's an extra solution you don't want, so it's better to think of it this way first, and after you establish the equivalence, set U squared to 1. So the idea is to plug G prime and U prime into that action and express the result as an action for G and U. What does it look like? Well, that was the most generally covariant action, so it must look like that. But it could have different values of the constants, and it does. So what can you do with that? You have this one free parameter V, so you can make some choice about these constants by choosing V. This is some work that Brendan Foster recently did. So C, the new CIs are some functions of the old CIs. And I won't give you the general formulae, but the most interesting thing you can do is to choose C1 plus C3 to be 0. And that's done by choosing B to equal 1 minus C1 prime minus C3 prime. And the reason that's an interesting thing to do is that if you look at this K, actually, it's all hockey stick here. C1 to C3. If we set C3 equal to minus C1, then the combination of these two terms just actually gives us a Maxwell-like Lagrangian for U, that is, it gives us the curl of U squared. That's nice because the covariant derivatives become ordinary partial derivatives and everything simplifies quite a bit. And that's just a choice we can make by Hilbert definition. So we just learned this recently, actually, and it hasn't been exploited very much, but I'll mention its ramifications. So if you do that choice, then what does the action look like? Then the ether Lagrangian becomes, is it some coefficient, I can't remember what, 1 or 2 or F A B F A B plus C2 divergence of U squared, and then we still have that C4 term, which we could write as U dot squared, where U dot is what we get when we contract the covariant derivative of U on the A index with UA, we get the acceleration of the congruence of the ether, and that's U dot, and this gives us the square effect. So it looks like, at least if we're just talking about ether and gravity, we can reduce to this for the most general Lagrangian.
I guess this only works if you're within the pure gravity or pure ether sector, right?
Because right. If you do this, if you weren't, then you would change the matter action, of course, by doing this. One thing though I did think about, and I haven't had much time to think about this, but suppose you started with a matter sector that did not break Lorentz symmetry and was coupled to the original G. Then all the matter would be coupled to the same new G, although it wouldn't be the same G as the one that's appearing here. It would be coupled to G prime. The original thing was coupled. But then the question is observationally, so this wouldn't produce any Lorentz violating effect in the pure matter sector. The matter metric would be E-prime, the background. You have to then look at situations where both gravity and non-gravitational effects are important, and I haven't thought about that. Okay, one more specialization I just want to mention. It turns out if you're just looking at spherically symmetric solutions, then you can even get rid of this C4 term. Because basically there's something called the twist vector, I think it could be written as U of du, thinking of U as a one form with its index lowered. This is zero in spherical symmetry. And so squaring this and using the fact that U is a unit vector, you get some identity involving derivatives of U. And that identity can be used to re-express this term as a combination of these terms. And so we can actually get rid of this term in spherical symmetry. So now it's getting extremely spherical. Can be eliminated. It's spherical symmetry. So that's the basics. Okay, so the first thing that you might want to look at is the simplest possible case where we just set all this to zero and we just have something like Maxwell theory. So these are the same as Maxwell theory. Well, no, it's pretty close, but we do have the unit constraint. And that's different because when you vary U, in effect, we're saying that you're only varying U with three independent parameters instead of four, so you're missing one of the Maxwell equations. The equation you're missing is the Gauss law. So a special case C2 equals C4 equals 0, C3 equals 0. This is Maxwell. And so if you're missing Gauss law.
Right, but also how many degrees of freedom in the Maxwell theory you have two, right?
Yeah.
And here you know you have three.
Yeah.
Because it's
so that's even more fundamental than having missing one degree.
Well, the thing is,
Well, that's
really interesting. But basically there's a mass term, and therefore you have a degree that's even more.
But there's no gauge invariance.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no only one gauge invariance, and therefore
it's
there's
not a mass
term.
It's not a mass
term.
It's not a mass
term. It's not a mass term. But three degrees.
Yes.
This well, the mass term is what when people write a protocol of the branch unit, then you would call lambda the mass of the both.
Yeah, but there's no mass of. Modes that propagate the mass. So if you linearize this, you get just two massless transverse modes as usual. And then you have some kind of weird longitudinal non-propagating thing, basically. Because if the Gauss law constraint holds at one time, then it holds at all times in this theory also. So it's not, that's a separate statement. But I don't know. It doesn't have a third wave-like mode.
So if you don't couple this theory to anything at all,
right,
would this third mode be coupled and the two transverse modes would behave exactly in the Maxwell theory, or there will be a difference?
There's a difference. Actually, we showed that you can rewrite this theory with this constraint as equivalent to a, I don't know if this helps answer it, but it's a charged dust. It's equivalent to a charged dust, where the charge to mass ratio of the dust is fixed by the value of this parameter C1 Lagrangian. But it's not all, it's a certain subsector of that theory, namely only those solutions where there exists a gauge in which the vector potential is equal to the forward velocity of the dust.
This is with sine 4 equals 0.
Yeah. So I think that shows you it's, I mean, that's the way of thinking about physical geology case, maybe. It's
with C4 equals 0, the longitudinal mode has just probably been with C4 not equal to 0.
Not equal to 0, yes.
Because that is, it gives you a time derivative of the longitudinal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll write down the general wave modes later, and you can see how they behave in this limit. It's kind of a strange limit. This theory, I think, is sick, and so after considering it, we moved on to more general case. But let me tell you what's some things that are sick about it. First of all, there's shocks. And secondly, there's negative energy. A very simple way to see the shock solutions, or the existence of shock-like behavior, is to consider a special case. Special solutions, where the vector potential is a gradient. So UA would be indexed down, where it's just gradient of a scalar. So if it is, then this field strength vanishes, and the equation of motion of the ether is going to be like the Maxwell equation with a current given by varying this U in the Lagrange multiplier term. So given that the field strength vanishes, the solution implies that, well, the equation implies that lambda is zero, the Lagrange multiplier vanishes. So with this zero, this equals this, and lambda equals zero, then the ether completely decouples, and the gravity part is just general relativity. So Einstein equation. So far, it doesn't look so bad. Certainly, it's not bad for the gravity. That's just Einstein gravity. But if you consider what happens to the ether now as it evolves, it actually has to maintain this constraint. And that's what inevitably leads to shock for the ether. And I think it's worth just explaining that simple thing. But the ether forms shocks, where the covariant derivative of the ether blows up. And so why is that true? I guess I want to, so take the so since U is constrained to the unit, its gradient of the square is zero, and this is equal to twice UB, actually let me put this down, UB grad AUB. But if U is a gradient, then this is the same as grad VUA. So evidently U satisfies the geodesic equation and it's a unit vector. So I can find a lot of solutions to this equation, of course. Take any initial views on a space-like surface and take the normal to the surface and evolved by the geodesic equation, and that solves this equation. But if you do that, generally you're going to, say you take a, in Minkowski space, the surface to be hyperboloid of a fixed norm, then the geodesics normal to that will all go through the origin, so they'll cross there. That means that at this point, there's no well-defined ether field, or rather the gradient of the ether field is infinite there. But more generally, if you just have any initial data, there will it will evolve to caustics. Or crossings. So these are shocks. Somehow they don't imprint on the gravity, but they're clearly not consistent with having a being able to evolve in the earth field.
But isn't that just because we don't allow the field to go to zero?
Well, that's part of it. Coming from the constraint.
But can you ever avoid that?
Yeah, I think if you don't have this peculiar degenerate. The problem here is that the Lagrangian only depends on the anti-symmetrized derivative of U. So it's insensitive to what's happening to the symmetric part. But if the action depended on sort of all components of the derivative, then the field equations would scream if you tried to make the symmetric derivative blow up. Something else would happen to the W. I believe. I mean, I haven't proved there are no shock solutions to the general equations, but.
But that does the scaling property that you mentioned at the beginning always work field to work with a non-view rate? You can always make that choice.
Wait a minute. That's my choice from the beginning. I want to. I elect to work with a non-view rate.
I know you elected. I'm asking you for it.
No.
So you could let up and avoid this catastrophe.
Well, I think then I'd have a catastrophe of negative energy.
But I mean,
no matter what, because of the indefinite Lorentz signature. What about the negative energy? Clayton wrote down the Hamiltonian for this theory. And, well, it's basically like a Maxwell Hamiltonian. And you can just see that there's some initial data you can choose that would have negative energy. I want to write it down because at first it seems to contradict the linearized results that I'll show you later. And that's a little bit interesting. So, say Pi is the momentum conjugate to Ui, so Pi squared. Plus pi of u naught, the time component. Oh, this is in the, so to make this analysis, he turns off gravity. So it's in the gravitational decoupling limit. The idea being that, you know, if the thing has positive energy, it should have positive energy in the limit that gravity is turned off, where Newton's constant is going to zero, but if it's got negative energy there, then surely it's got negative energy in general. That's the idea. So plus 1/4 of the spatial part of F squared. So an easy way to see that this does have negative energy solutions is to kind of combine this with this term and write it as Pi plus Pi u naught squared, and then subtract off the Vi u naught squared. So that's this part. So we could make this be negative if we could, say, make the field strength Fij be zero, and make this term be zero, then the result would just be negative. So we can make that zero by choosing pure gauge potential. So choose initial data. Ui to be the gradient of a scalar. And then choose the momentum to be minus Vi u naught. But that actually corresponds to, if you'd worked out the momentum, it would have been dt of ui minus pi of dt, or u naught. So pi plus the gradient of u naught is just the time derivative of ui. So by choosing the initial time derivative to be zero, turns out it's not doesn't remain zero on the evolution, but that will kill this term, it kills this term, so it's negative. So let's say D naught of, I guess it really means D naught of phi equals zero. This has negative energy. So that's a good reason to be unhappy with this. Okay, so maybe we can't get away with considering the simpler theory. We're going to have to consider the more generic one. Okay, so let's now look at, come back to the general theory and linearize, and just look at the spectrum of perturbations and see whether there's any chance that the theory is stable in the sense of not having exponentially growing modes, and then try to find the energy of those linearized modes and see if there's any choice of the C's so that that's always positive, and then you take it from there.
So it doesn't make any energy between the things that you go up in the, when you do the evolution. Does it seem that this mode U now decouples from the U I? So what you're doing is adding two quadratic fields. One where the inverted dynamics, but they are decoupled from each other. So, I mean, having negative energy doesn't always mean that you have blowing off modes. Suppose you take two oscillators, and then you just take decouple the oscillators. Yeah. You take for the second one, you know, you take the wrong sign. You look at the solutions, it's the usual solution.
Maybe,
for two oscillators.
Presumably, if I couple this.
Oh, if you couple it to. You know, it's maybe unstable under the perturbation, but negative energy doesn't mean instability. There's no equivalence between the two. It's.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, you need much more analysis to say that.
Well, technically, yeah, but you know any decent example that's.
Sorry, the one I was just giving to you.
No, but I mean.
No, when the negative energy comes
physical theory.
Yeah, I mean, when the negative energy comes from a potential term, it leads to catastrophe. But when it comes from a kinetic term, that's much more subtle in general. I mean, you're right. It means, you know, maybe it's simple, maybe it's not a potential negative
energy. Actually, that reminds me of the fact that the people that are working on ghost inflation or ghost condensation are playing with also negative, a theory that has a negative energy. And they are insisting that it's not obviously ruled out. But I'm going to say, for the same reason, I'm very skeptical about that.
Well, what if they see the meaning of very negative action, and if they see that only a small perturbation around the ground would be chosen, they have chosen to be. If you sort of look at the data picture, you'll have any information,
right.
And then of course you can find one way that exists.
Yeah. But you can work out the example of two decoupled harmonic oscillator, one with the wrong kinetic term, and you could find small perturbation which, you know, doesn't blow up the solution. So, of course, if you take large ones, then at some point it will blow up. So, that's maybe what you're seeing in the linearized regime. There's no going on modes.
Yeah, although the actually I'll get to that. For this theory there are no going on modes.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so in fact let's get to those modes now. Let's see. So because usually we have two independent modes per wave vector for gravity, transverse gravitons, but the unit vector can wiggle in three independent ways. So it makes you think there should be three more modes in general applied. They're going to be coupled in general. You have to fix a gauge and linearize the equations to find out what they were. I need an eraser. So let me just tell you the result. Linearized modes. We choose a gauge where, so the metric is Minkowski plus perturbation, and the ether is some background value plus a perturbation V. Choose coordinates so that this is just the one direction, doing the north direction. And choose the gauge so this is not I, where H0I is 0, and where the divergence of V is 0. Gauge choice. This is done with David Mattingly. So I just want to reproduce some aspect of the table of polarizations and waves. So we've got spin 2, spin 1, spin 0. Speed squared, so it turns out the frequency, all these modes are massless or gapless in the sense that omega squared is proportional to k squared with some coefficient, the square of the wave speed s, and that's what I'm going to put in this column. And here in the polarization, that is which components of h and v are non-zero. So this turns out to be 1 over 1 minus C13. And these are just the usual so I've chosen the free direction K equals K times V3. So the wave is propagating in the free direction. The speed here is kind of complicated. Maybe I'll just write down the limit of small c's, what it's equal to. In the limit of small c's, it's just c1 over c1 plus c4. So let me call that c14. So that just stands for c1 plus c4. I'll use that. I use that notation here also, actually, I see. And then polarization is this. The metric. Capital I stands for 1 and 2. So the 1, 3 or the 2, 3 component is equal to so the free root C1, 3, C1, 4 over C1 times VI. And then here, C1, 2, 3 over C1, 4. This is small. Limit. Right, yeah. And then there's page 0. Say about this. First thing, I guess it's interesting that remember I could arrange to set C1 plus C3 to 0 by Spielberg definition, and if I have done that, that would kill off this and this. So it would mean that the spin 2 waves travel at the same on the light cone of the metric G. And that there's no metric perturbation coupled to the transverse ether perturbation, but I still have this spin zero mode. If I ask for what values of the c's is s squared always positive, then I'm asking when have I excluded exponentially growing modes? And you can see that for small c's that requires that C1 over C14 is positive, and C123 over C14 is positive. So there's some range we can easily access that would be stable. Yeah, so by the way, for the case that we looked at, this sort of pure Maxwell case, C13 is zero. This is C1 plus C2 plus C3. And C2 is zero, so the numerator here is zero. The denominator is not, so the speed goes to zero. So it's that spin zero wave in that case is a non-propagating, just longitudinal field that's determined by the initial data. Okay. Oh, what about positive energy? Well, I haven't told you yet about how to compute the energy, but let me just say the result of, if you work out, for instance, one of the pseudotensor, energy momentum pseudotensors, and evaluated on plane wave solutions averaging over a cycle, you get an expression that gives you the sign of the energy that you would get at infinity, I think, if you had a bundle of these waves in space, giving you some well-defined total energy. It's kind of a trick to get at the energy of the wave, to just consider plane wave solutions, but look at the energy density, the pseudo energy density, and average over a cycle.
So that's what remains of the original energy constraint before you broke the regression variance.
Gravitational
one way is not great, the Lorentzian variance would be used, but then you have h equals 0, that's the energy constraint, because of the rebound regime variance with respect to time.
Yes.
So what remains of that?
So, well, you have an effective
everything
source
proportional to the u squared. Yeah, so, so everything is some function of u.
Everything, what do you mean?
The energy is some function of u, then. The energy density would be zero.
No, it wouldn't. Let's say you're talking about gravitational wave energy density. That's not zero. If you forget ether, take Einstein gravity, choose some pseudotensor, energy momentum pseudotensor, and use it to evaluate the energy density of gravitational waves, you'll get the non-zero positive energy density.
Yes.
This is just generalizing that.
But if you did the knowledge, for example, when you have H equals 6 and you have Q,
well,
then you would have
Some source
modification. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, you get the 0-0 component of the energy and momentum tensor of the ether.
Yeah.
In the Friedman equation. Actually, I'll mention cosmology. Yeah.
Since the U is supposed to be breaking local Lorentzian variance, it seems like it might be natural to try and define that gravitational energy relative to the U field.
Right. At infinity, you mean? Or just
and locally. Actually everywhere, but.
Yeah. Maybe. The thing is, there's no symmetry. I mean, normally the energy is especially meaningful when we're talking about a quantity that's conserved as a result of a symmetry of time transition. So just having a U doesn't give us symmetry. It does, however, at infinity, pick out a particular time-like direction for the time translation. And in this theory, you don't expect boost invariance under the whole system at infinity. So maybe at the energy in the asymptotic rest frame of the ethers behaves very differently than the energy in some other asymptotic frame.
But again, the question was, if you were using U contracted with the original constraint, which is not zero because of the system, so this is the operator that evolved along the field. Is your kind of picture.
Oh, I use U for the Hamiltonian flow. Yeah, that's interesting. I thought about that a little bit, and I think it deserves more thought. So something sort of like that was done years ago that's very interesting by Kukosh and
using the dust
Brown. They used the dust to for velocity, and it actually enabled them to reduce the Wheeler-DeWitt equation to a Schrodinger-like equation, which looked like it was enabling a kind of unitary interpretation of quantum gravity evolution equation. Very enticing, but the problem there, I think, is that the gauge, their dust, it's sort of like the Schatz problem. the gauge is not accessible globally. So in general, if you evolve for any amount of time, you will evolve out of the accessibility of the gauge condition they use to write the theory that way. They didn't emphasize this, but I think it's really the only reason why that's not something we should still be working on.
Is the shock problem really so terrible? What if you just had one shock in terms of the big bang?
No, I think it's ubiquitous shocks. I think it's the generic solution that shocks. In fact, since you mentioned this, the same problem afflicts this ghost condensation that people have been talking about. Let me just throw this in as a remark, because I think it's interesting. In ghost condensation, there's this strange kinetic term, and with a potential that's a function of the square of the gradient of the scalar field. And if the scalar field sits such that the gradient squared is at the bottom of that potential, then it's automatically a solution to its field equation. And they argue that as the universe expands, there's some Hubble friction that drives the field into that configuration. So let's say it's very near that. But that means I can use this argument that I gave you for shocks here. If you take a scalar field whose gradient has a fixed norm, then the argument I gave for the evolution of shocks applies. And it actually explains the thing that they mentioned recently, which is that there are strong nonlinearities in their field equations that arise not when you would not expect it. Not because of any strong gravity or anything, but just because the gradient of the ghost field becomes large. And the reason for it is exactly the same as what I was showing you, just that if you try to evolve a scalar field such that its gradient has a fixed norm, it always will evolve shocks ubiquitously. They argue that that's not a big problem. But it's not clear to me. I think they haven't shown that. They've looked at very homogeneous situations where it's not obviously a problem. Sorry.
You think that it's due more to the cognitive than to dynamics, right? I mean, for example, you know, the fixed point theorem, so everybody has on his head, right, a point where the hair go like this, right? And you have basically a zero as far as vector fields are concerned. I suppose when you enforce that you have a vector field with constant length, you are making global choices here.
Yeah.
Basically, you exclude something that occurs. Right? Because if you have something that occurs,
you have curve solution? Is that what you said?
Curl. In two dimensions, I think that's what it would mean. If you have a field that has curves in two dimensions, you can't have it vanish.
Yeah.
You can't have it non-vanishing anything.
Okay, so we're not in two dimensions.
No, but there are generalizations to that.
Yeah, but I think there are lots and lots of solutions that are non-zero.
Like, why can't you have, you're thinking of a closed manifold or something like that. This is open. It's open in the time direction.
Yeah.
Well, we're not still a few minutes left. Mark,
okay, but I want to tell you about some interesting things like black hole solutions and I'll try to jump. Let's see. So
Can I ask you one thing? So to make the parallel with the Gauss condensation. So
yeah.
Where you got the speed of speed of zero, right? Which is the last one here. These guys would say, oh, there are five dimensional operators that would give you k to the fourth term, right? And they play with that.
Yes.
Right? And because you don't put five dimensional operators, you don't get
that's exactly right. So
you'll get the weirdly propagating modes if you add the five-dimensional derivatives.
Right. Yeah. Also, those derivatives will regulate the shocks, but there'll be very strange evolution where it was unexpected. Yeah, I mean, maybe we should do the same thing. But see, if shocks evolve when they shouldn't, in the sense that this geometry is smooth and curvature is low and nothing strange is happening, then I think the theory would easily be shown to be non-viable observationally, I guess.
So why
there's a lot to do with that.
So why not hang on to the square equal to one for their life?
Because that's my principle. I want to make a theory of a preferred Lorentz theory. That's it. I'm not interested in any old field theory.
No, but you can have such timeline vectors which are not normal.
But the norm has nothing to do with the idea of trying to implement. And again, I'll say that I think it's the norm of negative energy anyway, so
I think I have no water. The negative energy is a different thing.
Yeah.
And so you always come back to the second argument.
Okay, I'll give it that. I'll give it first.
I don't agree that you should allow it to go to zero. Fine. It doesn't violate the invalidating principle, but it might just get rid of the dark.
You try it. Okay.
The topology isn't interesting here.
Okay, let me see what I should summarize. Okay, energy. I just wanted to say, so checking the energy of linearized modes. The condition for positive energy, positive, implies C1 is greater than or equal to zero, and C14 is greater than or equal to zero. Remember, the condition for stability was C1 over C4 is greater than or equal to zero, so that's implied by that. And then also we need C1, 2, 3 positive. So again, it's cutting down this region, but we still have giant regions of parameter space that now satisfy both positive energy of linearized modes and stability. But how can I claim to you that all the modes have positive energy when I showed you here that this special case, which fits in there, has some negative energy data? Now, it's true that the negative energy mode there is the one that's actually not a propagating wave mode. But a more instructive answer, I think, is this fact. It's that this energy is actually quartic in the perturbation. It looks like quadratic. It's quadratic in the U0. But U0 is U0 squared minus UI squared is 1, is the constraint. So for a perturbation, U0 is 1 without the perturbation, so it's 1 plus something small, and that something small thing is of order UI squared, that's what I'm trying to say here. The perturbation of U0 is quadratic in the perturbation of UI. And therefore, this thing is quartic, so it wouldn't anyway be seen in the linearized analysis. Now, this should make me quake in my boots, because if this thing can escape positivity of the linearized theory, then why isn't the whole thing going to be sick similarly? And my answer to that, why do I keep going, is that, well, if I restrict, I know one example where the decoupled limit, it's got positive energy, and that's the one where I only have C1 non-zero. And the reason I know that is positive energy is that's nothing but a nonlinear sigma model, which where the field lives on the spatial unit hyperboloid. And we know that nonlinear sigma models have positive energy. So in the gravitational decoupled limit, I know that one does. Fully nonlinear theory does. So I think it's still worth trying to, I still believe that there will be sectors that have positive energy of the nonlinear theory.
So does that negative energy mode show up as a zero energy mode in the perturbation?
Good question. I don't remember the expression for the energy for that spin zero mode. I can check.
Have you tried just redoing the proofs for some of the positive energy theorems?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I should have said. They don't work. Because, so you could just look at this ether as some funny kind of matter and look at its stress energy tensor, and if it satisfied the dominant energy condition, that would be finished. But it doesn't. Appear to. I mean, there's no. Okay. I should quickly mention a couple of other things and then stop. The post-Newtonian parameter. So if it survives, you know, the basic theoretical checks, you should compare it with solar system tests and ultimately gravitational wave phenomena. Chris Ealing and I computed the Eddington-Robertson shift parameter. So there are 10 ppm parameters. But 5 of them vanish automatically for any Lagrangian theory. So we only have to consider beta, gamma, I think it's called psi, alpha 1 and alpha 2. These actually are equal to 1, which is the same as in GR. This is what Chris Ealing and I showed. this hasn't been computed, but it's probably zero because it's related to preferred location effects. And according to Clickwell, this theory probably doesn't happen. So probably zero, but it hasn't been computed. Clickwell. These two have to do with preferred frame effects, and of course it's a preferred frame theory, so they shouldn't vanish, presumably. Observational bounds on these today are of order 10 to the minus 4 for alpha 1 and 10 to the minus 7 for alpha 2. And just a little while ago, Sigarsky and Zloshchestiev, I think, posted a paper claiming to get a bound due to preferred frame effects of order 10 to the minus 42 on the coefficients in this Lagrangian. Coming from the planarity of the planet orbits in the solar system. So if the sun is moving relative to the asymptotic ether, then the gravitational field seen by the planets has an anisotropy, and that introduces a strange term in the basically force law, and over a long period of time, the orbits would just do crazy things depending on how far, and it would depend on how far the sun is from the sun. They assumed they could use the two issues with their calculation, and they're currently looking into these. One is they assumed that they could just, they computed the initial effect, and then they assumed they could multiply by the amount of time the solar system has existed to just kind of integrate the angle. But actually, it could more well be that every half orbit, the sign of the effect changes. So it's actually not a secular effect. I don't think that it's plausible that since the best upper bound in alpha 2 today from everything anybody's been able to do is 10 to the minus 7, that they could get 10 to the minus 4, 42, sorry. So maybe they'll wind up getting something more of this order.
Okay, can they control the electrical mechanics that way with all the perturbations?
It was a difficult calculation, actually.
About everything, but exception.
They linearized the whole problem, did a lot of computer algebra, and it was hard. It looked like.
Oh, no.
I can't believe the result is right, but probably they'll correct whatever they did wrong and get some result out of the case. No, I agree. But the good thing is there are going to be some bounds on these parameters, which will imply some. Oh, they are bounds. They'll impose bounds on the seed. Okay, let me wrap up by just mentioning a little bit about the question of black hole solutions and tell you what we know about them. So the first interesting observation is, you know, if you draw the crustal diagram for a Schwarzschild black hole, or you think about any black hole with a bifurcated Killing horizon, you realize that there cannot be such a black hole in this theory that where the ether field is regular at this point. And the reason is that, static black hole. So no static black hole with ether regular at bifurcation surface. And the reason is very simple. It's just that the flow of the Killing field goes like this here. So suppose I had some value of this vector in the tangent space on the bifurcation surface, then the flow of this Killing flow would necessarily move this vector to some other vector. But then that vector field couldn't be invariant under the flow. So I can't write down a metric and ether that are invariant under this flow. It's just impossible. So there could be no regular ether there. And that might make you think that there's just no regular black hole solutions in this theory. Because somehow, suppose I had a regular ether here, somewhere up here on the horizon, and couldn't I just sort of flow it down to here by the Killing flow, and I know it can't exist there. Okay, well, but the thing is, I can't flow it back, but it could blow up as I flow it back, and it certainly does. So there are perfectly good unit vector fields you can write down in this space-time, which blow up as you flow to the bifurcation surface. Now, That doesn't mean that the stress energy tensor of that ether field blows up. It just means the ether does. So we considered it worth looking for solutions, not the bifurcation surface, but in an Eddington-Finkelstein-like coordinate path, so like this. Just writing down the unsats for a black hole, imposing the condition of having a regular event horizon, and what do we get? So we found that, this is with Chris Ealing, we found that by numerical evolution, there are regular black hole solutions. We also know from that are static. We also know from a theorem of Wald and Rosen-Wald that any such solution can be extended to a metric with a regular bifurcation surface. So the metric in that solution has a regular extension to the neighborhood of here. And they showed conditions under which the matter fields on such a solution also can be extended to having regular values in the neighborhood of the bifurcation surface. And the condition on the matter fields was that they, there was a condition that they'd be invariant under a time reflection isometry. But the ether, by its very essence, is not, because it's pointing, it's a time-like vector, and it's pointing one way in time. So it doesn't have that invariance, and that, so that's consistent with it not having a regular extension. But again, I don't think that implies there's anything wrong with the solutions up here that we found. Currently, this is sort of, we're just in the midst of all this, and I'm quite confused by something. Namely, it seems like there's a one parameter family of black, so if we fix the horizon size, horizon area, then we have some free parameters to choose as shooting parameters, and by adjusting them, we find values that, that integrate out to asymptotically flat solutions. And we find a one parameter family of black hole solutions for a given horizon size. This would be like maybe having a charge. The black hole has a mass, maybe sort of determined by the horizon size, but it also has a charge. In fact, we knew already that in a purely Maxwell-like case, there are black hole solutions with a, an extra parameter. In fact, there are Rosen-Rosen solutions. So maybe it's not that surprising that there's a charge, except for the fact that the ether falls off faster than the electromagnetic field does. So I'm very puzzled by this charge thing. And not only that, it's even worse, because it seems like there's a discrete family of one parameter solutions.
This, this charge being encoded in the U field.
Yeah, but it's not the flux of the curl of U, dual of the curl of U at infinity or anything, because that actually goes to zero because U's falling off fast enough for that not to contribute. So it's somehow some kind of a hair. I shouldn't really call it charge maybe, but some one parameter family of
U hair.
What?
U hair.
Yeah. It's very curious. See, at this point, I have to confess to you, there's an aspect of this theory that I'm just interested in as a field theory. I don't even care if it relates to nature at this point. People spend their careers studying Einstein-Yang-Mills black holes, for instance. Now, I won't defend that, but it is interesting mathematically. What is the structure of the space of solutions to these things? And so this is a very different kind of nonlinear field theory, which seems very different. Another strange difference we discovered, I've never seen this before, and tell me if you have, we integrated into the horizon as well as out to see what the singularity looks like. And it seems like it becomes singular, the solution becomes singular at a finite radius on the inside of the black hole. Whereas every other black hole solution I know of, the singularity on the inside is at zero radius. So please tell me if you know a case where it's at finite radius. I can't vouch for these results as being definitely correct, because we're just in the middle of it, but it looks quite intriguing. Maybe I better stop here. All right.
Doesn't the binary pulsar put very tight constraints on a lot of those parameters? I mean, you can't have the energy law such that, I mean, if C13 isn't zero, and speed of gravitational waves isn't the speed of light, I think that really bollocks up the binary pulsar data. So I would expect there to be some very tight constraints somehow coming
well,
out.
Well, there I don't expect, okay, so for, we're talking about the rate of energy. More worse than that is, what about all the extra energy radiated in the other modes?
Yes.
It's just change, this might change the rate of radiation by something of order C13. Since it's only measured to an order tenth of a percent to agree with GR, then maybe you get it down in order.
Yeah, but combined with the spin zero.
These, I mean, yeah, so absolutely. And we, the thing is that nobody has yet calculated what kind of waves of this mode would be created by the binary pulsar. It's not an easy thing, but it should be known.
The Abbot modes are more or less like goldstones on the breaking of Lorentz invariants. Therefore, they have to couple derivatively, in essence. And from that argument, I think their rate of emission of this mode would be finally suppressed.
I just have
a comment. You asked a question, what is the regular pulse which have a regular horizon?
Yes.
And so in fact there are, and those are just, you know, you could take standard supergravity, so there are some supersymmetric solutions which have a naked time-like singularity. And so you can heat up the supersymmetric solutions, put the horizon, and it will cover the naked singularities there. Because those are solutions that come when you study brains on quantum.
Right, but what is this an example of?
It's, I don't know if you're familiar with the Von Strassler series. So those are.
No, but I mean, not where they're coming from, but what is what is the structure that it's illustrating? That's what I mean.
Oh, you mean why it happens that there is a singularity not at r equals 0? But
oh, it's not at r equals 0?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying. That's exactly an example of.
Oh, I want. Can you give me a reference?
Sure.
You started to say something about discrete family of one-parameter solutions.
Yeah, just the numerical evidence shows that, and I don't understand why they should be there. In Einstein-Yang-Wills case, there is a discrete set, but that's related to the existence of nodes in the radial function describing the Yang-Wills field. In this case, there are no nodes. So I just don't get why there should be a discrete set.
Yeah. In Einstein Fine-Grove theory, the scalar field has a mass. We saw the equations for the static solution. There are no event horizons. There's a latency horizon. Provided it has a mass, you can get branches of stable solutions with half. But the singularity is at a point. And the singularity. But there are no event horizons.
Oh, no.
So there are still things out there that need to know about.
All right.
I've tried making a dynamic for the potential of UI to drive the spontaneous breakdown of Lorentzian variance.
John has, I think. Several people have. I think actually we should talk about that, but there may be a problem because then you have a length mode of this vector, and I think the energy of that has the wrong sign if the energy of the other mode has the right sign.
Well, it depends on comparing SRT one times to O3. I think it has the right sign. One you look like one two. You just keep the rotation to it. The first approach.
Let's talk about
them. Yeah. All right. Let's try to give us a